Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and today, or this evening, hopefully our guest is going to be Joan Vion, who has attended probably more of the international meetings of the elite, where the rulers of the world get together, than any other person I know, and Joan certainly is been able to give us a great deal of insight into what these people of great wealth and great power are up to. Now, this evening, I hope we're going to be able to at least touch on the royalty of Europe. Most people don't think of the royalty anymore, but there has been for probably 50 years or more, maybe 100 years or more, a group known as the Black Nobility. They are the royal houses of Europe that often interlock, many times have intermarried. You know, at one time, why, of course, the royal house of Germany and of England and of Russia, they were all interrelated. They were all cousins of one another until the time of the First World War, and at which time, why, the king of England at that time betrayed his cousin in Germany, assuring them if there was a world war, they wouldn't enter. And of course, they betrayed the family in Russia as well. And we know from one of our friends who went through the papers there, Lenin's papers in Moscow, that the communists offered to give the Tsar and his wife and his family, let them go to England, and the English wouldn't take them, knowing that if they were not allowed to come to England as refugees, had been killed. But of course, these people are treacherous and wicked people. They're after power. But they do exist today. They've existed there for a long time. They have great wealth and power, and we're talking about the royal houses of Holland and Belgium and certainly Spain, and then there are leftovers from the various monarchies of Central Europe as well. So Joan has done a study on this, and I'm going to let her talk a little bit about these royal houses and how they interlock. For instance, you hear Royal Dutch Shell. What does that mean? Well, it really means, of course, that Holland, the Dutch monarchy, actually owns Royal Dutch Shell, one of the wealthiest oil companies in the world. British Petroleum is largely owned by the British royal family and the British government. You're not hearing about these things. You really don't understand. We do have royal families here in the United States. They're called the Rockefellers. They own Exxon, Chevron. They own Citibank. They own Chase Manhattan Bank. They control the wealth of the world largely. And of course, if you honestly believe Warren Buffett and Bill Gates are the richest men in the United States, you've been listening to Rush Limbaugh too long. But with that as a background, Joan Vion, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, Dr. Stan, it's always a joy and an honor to be on your show. Back in 1995, I wrote a book called Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. And at that time, I never, ever dreamed that I would write a book about the British royal family, i.e. specifically Prince Charles and his role in behind the scenes with regard to Agenda 21, Sustainable Development, and the Biological Diversity Treaty. I have watched royalty for many, many years, but I have watched it very closely since 1995, when I wrote my book on Prince Charles. However, I was extremely amazed, having covered the World Economic Forum for since 1998, I have been very amazed to see many various royal personages at that meeting.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. All right, Joan, pick the story up. You're talking about the royal personages at these international financial meetings. So go ahead.
So occasionally I would see the King and Queen of Sweden, or I would see the Prince of Liechtenstein, or Prince Albert. I never saw Prince Rainier, but I did see Prince Albert. And I would see different members of various royal families different years. But last year, end of January, when I was at the World Economic Forum for 2006, I was absolutely amazed because there were three crown princes from different countries there at the meeting all at the same time, something I had not seen before. And when I asked Professor Klaus Schwab, who is the originator and founder of the World Economic Forum, I was really playing dumb when I said to him, why isn't Prince Charles here? There are three crown princes here. He said in a very monotone voice that Prince Charles had been there, and he was there, I think, in 1991, and Princess Anne was there in 1999. But in any event, he said that every member, with the exception of the Queen, of the British royal family, had been at the World Economic Forum. And that started my quest to take a look at the various royal houses of Europe. And so that's what I am doing in UN Watch, which is the magazine that supports the Women's International Media Group, and that supports my activities in going to these various international meetings. And as I started to put this together, first of all, let me say that there is no coincidence, in my opinion, there is no doubt, in my opinion, that all of the various royal families happen to be pro-environmental. There is no surprise that the various royal families that have been, in my opinion, have been allowed to exist since the upheaval in Europe in the 1850s into the early 19th century, whereby many royal families were replaced by socialism and communism, that the existing royal families really constitute a handful of very closely related inner circle royalty. When you start taking a look at who runs the world, it is Queen Elizabeth. And I remember back in 1990 or 1991, before I ever started covering international meetings,
Joan, I'm going to interrupt you right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stad, and Joan was simply saying that as she goes to these international meetings, she finds that, you know, the royalty from the various houses, not only of Great Britain, but all throughout Europe, the royalty are at these international financial meetings, the World Economic Council meetings. And, of course, in my own personal experience, I found that these people very often are interrelated with the banking interests of their own countries or of all of the countries of Europe. And interlock with all of these people we talk about is the Brotherhood of Darkness. And Joan was just saying that it is not simply by accident that all of these people are tied into environmentalism. In fact, Prince Charles is coming to be known as the Green Prince. He wants to have a sustainable lifestyle. He's going to be riding his bicycle more while the chauffeur drives the car behind him, because he wants to show, you know, we've got to get away from consuming so much fuel. In fact, he's not using the royal yacht or the royal planes as much as he used to. He's stressing the importance of sustainability. Prince Charles, the sustainable prince. So go ahead, Joan.
And so there is an inner core. When you start taking a look at the leading royal families, you will find, I was talking about in 1990, 1991, I read the book The Committee of 300 by Dr. John Coleman. And I remember in that book he cited an inner group of people who were running the world, and that Queen Elizabeth was the head of the Committee of 300. Well, you know, that was, at that time, I didn't have the background that I have now and the foundation, so that was, like, really amazing. Well, now that I've been around the world a few times and I've been to over 90 global meetings and I've done the research that I have done, it is not far-fetched to see, especially when most of the other royal families of Europe, whether it is Norway or whether it is Sweden or whether it is Holland or Liechtenstein, most of the other royal families are members and serve on Queen Elizabeth's Order of the Garter, which is her very, very, well, it's an occultic group.
This really goes back to the 1400s. I mean, this has been around for a long time.
That's right. That's right. And it's all occultic. And, you know, you have the various kings of Sweden and Norway and the Queen of Holland. And
Don't forget the Japanese emperor who was there before the Second World War had to drop out while his country was fighting the Allies and then came back in right after that. But you notice the problem, if there was one man who was responsible for Japanese entry in the war, it was Hirohito. But, of course, as a member of the Garter, he could not be punished. Nobody ever talks about this sort of thing. Most people have never heard of the Order of the Garter, this ancient occult organization. You're absolutely right. And I wish this is one of those organizations that people never talk about.
Yeah, it's amazing because, Dr. Stan, you know, I'm of Italian descent, and so I learned very early on about the Italian mafia who, you know, have their own way of ruling their provinces, but, you know, we all know that the world is run by mafias, but most people do not consider the royal families as a mafia, and that's exactly what they are. What is a king? What is a queen? What is a duke? What is a prince? Well, they all, you know, the king or the queen is nothing but the king of the hill, literally, the king of the hill. And they did whatever it took to overcome and be more powerful than all of the other lesser dukes, lords, kings, and princes around them. And so this is still happening today. There is a fight for control of the world. And when I wrote my book, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince, I'll tell you what, it was not my intention to say that the British royal family is the power behind the United Nations, and that was their way of taking back America. But indeed, there is a major play for all the countries of the world, and I have yet, in the number of years, that 10, 12 years that Prince Charles has been out, to ever determine that I was wrong in my assumption or my thesis. So what we have here is, and I find it very fascinating, and I'm sure you do too, Dr. Stan, the rise of the Rothschilds in world affairs and how they too have become very tightly woven to the British royal family. Mayor Bauer Amschel had 5 sons, and he scattered them all over Europe with their own banking house, and the Rothschild of England, through doing such Herculean things, such as financing the Boer War in South Africa to bring all the gold and diamond fortunes of South Africa into the British royal treasury, he was given a lifelong peerage in England. And as such, they were busy financing royalty all over Europe way before, so that they were tightly ensconced wherever they could get ensconced in order to become their own kind of royalty. Maybe we could call them the king of usury, or the emperors of usury, or the emperor of world usury, because of where they are and what they've done. And yet they've married into royalty. They've married into royalty all over Europe. And so we have different levels of families working to basically deconstruct the world as we know it. And they're doing it through the United Nations, through Agenda 21, the Biological Diversity Treaty. Dr. Stan, I mean, I'm not telling you anything, but when you start taking a look at, for example, Prince Bernard, who's now dead, of Holland, he started the Bilderbergers. And when you take a look at some of his other activities, Prince Bernard of Holland and Prince Philip of England started the World Wildlife Federation. And so they were involved in setting the foundation of non-governmental organizations that would help facilitate Agenda 21 when it was foisted officially on the world in 1992.
And, of course, you know how the environmental movement that has been used to destroy competition. Oh, we can't have offshore drilling. We can't have drilling here in any public lands in the United States. We have to regulate any drilling for oil or for natural gas in the United States to create artificial shortages. If you have an abundance, and there's so much oil in the world, the world is awash with oil, and not, of course, they created this myth of peak oil, we're running out of oil, we're running out of natural gas, we're running out of water, we're running out of clean air, oh my goodness, we need a whole series of new government laws. But these people have financed the environmental movement that destroyed their opposition and used government regulations so that we would have now about five major oil companies, and certainly between British Petroleum, English Royal Family, Royal Dutch Shell, why the Dutch Royal Family, and of course Chevron and Exxon here in the United States, the American Royal Family, the Rockefellers, why you can see how it all fits together and how important environmentalism is, you know, and how effectively they've used that to destroy and use government to destroy opposition.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And it's very interesting, you know, when I started putting this together to take a look at, for example, you know, I remember when I was at my first global meeting in 1994, there was a man there who at that time, I had no idea who he was, and he was busy talking about how he was coming out, he was the co-chair, Sridath Ramphal, Sir Sridath Ramphal from Guyana. And he was the co-chair of a new report coming out called Our Common Future. And, Our Global Neighborhood. And it took me over a year or two to connect him with the British Commonwealth. He was the president of the British Commonwealth. And so when you started to take a look at, for example, key people who were writing major reports to sustain and support Agenda 21 and the environmental agenda, you started then to see that the presidents and the prime ministers of leading countries such as Sweden with their own royal family, that there they were, whether it was Sweden or Norway or Denmark, that there they were writing these major reports, Our Global Neighborhood, and other reports that substantiated the environmental movement. And so you had not only the royal family of that country, but of course, look, anybody who thinks, like for example in England, that Tony Blair is the prime minister and that he is elected by the people, and that he has greater power than the Queen, I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I want to sell them. Because in all of these countries, whether it's Holland or Sweden or Denmark or Norway, as well as Britain, it is not the prime minister that runs the country. It is the monarch. And if anybody has not seen the movie The Queen, that was a powerful movie from the standpoint that it truly showed she runs the country.
Well, certainly it's the same here in the United States. Anybody who thinks that George Bush is really running the United States, maybe we can sell them that same bridge. George Bush is a figurehead in the United States, just as Tony Blair is a figurehead, certainly over in London. So the average American really doesn't understand the power structure that runs the world, and behind all of this are the secret societies and the powerful forces that are intent upon creating a world government and a new world religion. We'll be back in just a moment with Joan Vian as we begin to explore the royalty of Europe, and they are interlocked with the financial centers of the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Joan, in your studying, certainly you've noticed the relationship between this royalty and these financial centers and banking and international and central banking, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the biggest surprises in my recent life was to find out through my research that there was a complete takeover of the royal family in England, and that when King Charles was deposed, he was the Stuart King, when he was deposed by his daughter and son-in-law, who subsequently became King William and Queen Mary of England, they came over from Holland. His daughter, Charles' daughter Anne, had gone to Holland and married her cousin, and so anyway, they completely overthrew Charles. He was Catholic, and William was Protestant, and this was in between Cromwell. But the reason for William and Mary coming over to England was nothing less than setting up the Central Bank of England, the Bank of England, which used usury. And if England had a Catholic king, the Vatican would not have allowed usury or a central bank to be set up in England. But because it came through the Protestants, William and Mary, William of Orange, it was okay, and therefore that is one of the key, I guess you could call it, foundation stones to this whole idea of central banking taking over the world. Now, you know, I remember when I was studying the Bank of England and the whole idea of central banking running the world, I said to myself, "Yeah, I bet the British royal family is a key stockholder in the Bank of England." But I had no proof. And somebody called me one day and they said, "You have to get this video." And it was a video done by Prince Edward. He had this little movie company, and so he was making movies about his forefathers. And sure enough, in one of his movies, he actually talked about how his forefather, King William, was one of the largest contributors when they set up the Bank of England. Yeah. And he showed the document and everything.
And what was that, about 1694, and that was William Paterson, wasn't it?
That's right. William Paterson was the unscrupulous businessman who was used to come up with this awesome idea.
Well, and I think what people have to understand is what this does, it allows people to create money out of nothing. And it was that the central banking concept that allowed, of course, Great Britain, to, first of all, to defeat Napoleon. Napoleon wanted to use gold to fire his armies and buy his munitions. The British were able to use this scam of creating money out of nothing so they could outspend Napoleon and hire all sorts of mercenary armies. And then, of course, it was this whole banking system of artificial money that allowed Great Britain to create the great empire that, well, at one time they said the sun never set on the British Empire. But it was all done with the fiat money system where they could artificially create money and great wealth. The same sort of system we've adopted. The trouble is the English system eventually collapsed, and, well, America's on the verge of collapse right now. But we can't let the American people know. Only the elite know what really lies ahead. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joan Vian, and we're talking about the relationship between the British royal family and the Central Bank of England, which was established, and I think it was about 1694, by a man named Mr. William Paterson. But the British royal family is one of the largest financial holders of this bank. Certainly the major central bank of Europe, for which all of the other central banks took off. Now, there have been a few banks before in Florence and Venice, this was the first major central bank and that has existed ever since the 1694. And then, of course, America's central bank was taken off of that. And eventually, of course, the America's central bank, the Federal Reserve System, has become the dominant central bank of the world. So pick up the story there, Joan.
Well, it's very interesting. I truly believe now, I mean, there are those who say that the Federal Reserve is owned by the Schiffs and the Kuhns and the Loebs, and I'm sure they're Rothschilds and I'm sure they're Rockefellers, but I'm also sure the British royal family. I mean, this awesome idea of usury, I'm sure that they have supported and been key contributors to all of the central banks that were set up after the Bank of England. They would be truly stupid not to be part of all of that.
I'm sure they are. In fact, you know, for many, many years, the Catholic Church really had objected to this concept of usury. And it really wasn't, of course, until Francis Bacon came along in the early 1600s and put out all sorts of phony excuses for this. And, of course, this was long-term planning. Bacon was a Rosicrucian, part of this whole world occult system, that he was able to convince the British government that maybe usury wasn't so bad. And that, of course, led to the central bank and then the central banking system that now dominates the world and has created tremendous prosperity for China and for India and for countries throughout the world as we, of course, transfer America's wealth throughout the world and as we look forward to the collapse of America's middle class and the impoverishment of our people. But it's all part of their plan. These people really control the world, and we are simply to be experimented on. So pick up the story there.
Dr. Stan, I love where you have me pick up the story. Yes, it's all a great experiment, and you and I are part of the guinea pigs. And it's very, very sad. You know, Dr. Stan, when you start taking a look at what has happened, let's just talk about, for a moment, from the crash of the Internet, or the NASDAQ stocks, whatever you want to call them. That happened in 2000, and $7 trillion just vanished instantaneously when the NASDAQ crashed. Well, that was all planned, managed, manipulated, and controlled. And that money was transferred from a lot of middle-class people, a lot of people who put their savings in these Internet stocks thinking that they were going to be filthy rich. That wealth was transferred from them to the people who run the world. There was a major transfer of wealth. And so then the central banks, not trying to cover their tracks, dropped interest rates like they did here in the United States to 45-year lows. Joe Average says, wow, I can now borrow more money because interest rates have gone down or prime rate has gone down to 1%, I can now borrow more money and buy that big luxurious house. Isn't that a scream? So all these people have now bought the big luxurious house. Interest rates are now on their way up. We're looking at a dollar that is being devalued far more than at any other, I can't say at any other time in history, but at any other time since the 1980, or was it 85, Plaza Accord. And the dollar has dropped, what, another 6% in the last month or so, to the point whereby I think the dollar is down in value since 1973 at least 75%. And it's going to get harder for Joe Average to make ends meet, given the fact that interest rates are going up, the economy is slowing, the dollar appears to be dying, and they've gone out and they've borrowed far more than they can handle. And look what the banks did. That was a coup, if I ever saw one. Joe Average has walked right into the lion's den without realizing what they've done.
And, of course, they've lowered the margin requirements on the stock market down to about 10%. And a lot of people are just running in there. They can borrow all that money and speculate in the stock market. And, oh, they're going to get so rich. And they don't understand. That's not how the game is played. The game is not played for them to get rich. Mm-hmm. It's for the other people to get rich. Everything is motivated by greed and then by fear. Greed when you think you're going to make money, and fear when you realize you've been had. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're in the market at the present time on margin, get out, run for cover, because believe me, it's coming very rapidly. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Joan Vian. Go ahead, Joan, pick up the story. I certainly agree. I share your concern about what's happening, and I should mention for our listeners that Joan actually makes her living as a financial consultant, stock investment, and I know that some of the people who've invested with her in the past have done very well. They've been very, very happy. So I'm going, when we get all of our stations back on board, I'll let you get your telephone number out. But right now, you pick up the story.
What I'd like to do is go back to Napoleon. You mentioned Napoleon and how he was using gold while the British started to use usury. That was a major coup. But there was something else that Napoleon did. As you know, that Napoleon basically reconstructed the whole face of Europe so that when he was finally defeated, they called for the Congress of Vienna. And it is very interesting that at the Congress of Vienna, that all of Europe's map was redrawn because of the destruction of Napoleon. And it is very interesting when we start taking a look at who got what, that Great Britain, of course, came out on top. They received parts of the West Indies, which were given to them by Holland and Spain. They kept the former Dutch colonies of Ceylon and Cape Colony, as well as Malta. And they received a protectorate over the United States, of the Ionian Islands and the Shelleys. Norway was transferred to Sweden from Denmark and eventually gained its independence. Switzerland was guaranteed neutrality. The Papal States were restored to their former extent. Holland, the House of Orange, was given the Dutch Republic and part of the Austrian Netherlands to rule, and then Austria gained its independence later on. And we have Poland was given some, Russia was given Poland and allowed to keep Finland, and then that was annexed. So you start seeing this. Sort of like the chair game being played in Europe. But at the Congress of Vienna, it was amazing because the British just finagled their way to on top. And so we have seen at every turn, the sun never sets on the British Empire, because when you start taking a look at the British Empire...
Well, that will be back in just a moment here, Joan. Well, Dr. Stan, Joan's been talking about the Congress of Vienna and how, of course, after the Napoleonic Wars, why Europe was carved up. But, of course, it just seemed that the British ended up on top of the pile and getting the most concessions as they divided up Europe after it had been conquered by Napoleon. Now, what most people don't understand is that Napoleon himself was a member of a secret society. It was because he was a Mason that he actually became, first of all, the leader of France and then the Emperor of France. But without the influence of Masonry behind Napoleon, he never would have accomplished what he did. But most people don't understand the influence of Masonry and the other secret societies on the unfolding of world events. Joan, before we go on, I want you to get out your telephone number and how people can get in touch with both the women's group and if they'd like to get a hold of you as a financial advisor. Don't be bashful.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. If people would like to know more about the women's group, the materials that we offer, we have a brand new video out. I almost forgot to mention that. We have a brand new video out.
Put a plug in for it.
That's right. It's 2.5 hours, and it will connect the dots on the world government system that we have, the political, the economic, the environmental. It's well worth the $25.95 plus shipping, and I would highly recommend that you get a copy of it. To do that, you can call 301-371-0541, 301-371-0541. You can go to our website, womensgroup.org. www.womensgroup.org. For people who would like to know more about the financial planning and investment advisory services that we offer through Vion Financial Services, please feel free to call us at 301-371-0540, 301-371-0540. We'll send you out a complimentary economic newsletter and a brochure on Vion Financial.
All right, fine. All right, fine. Well, let's pick up the story of the nobility of Europe. And really, I was so fascinated. Is that that article that you wrote on the nobility? People can get that through the women's group?
Yes, they can do that.
All right, fine. It's well worthwhile getting. I was very impressed by it. And because Joan is the only person I know who's really written on the interrelationship between all the royal houses of Europe, and the banking and the wealth, and then, of course, some of them tie into the Order of the Garter. But there is the cult foundation. Of course, they tie into the Club of Rome as well. All of these occult organizations have a common denominator, whether they're, and they interlock with the organizations here. They all are moving towards a world government under a ruling elite. They're not that many people, but they certainly are in positions of power. And they're able to conceal their existence because they control the media and ultimately what the people of America, indeed what most people throughout the world actually hear, see, and ultimately come to believe. So go ahead, Joan.
Well, you know, it's very interesting when we see the world moving in a world governmental system. People say, well, who's on top? Well, let me go back to the British royal family, and I'm not trying to pick on them, but it just so happens that they deserve it. Well, you know, when I did a major report on the British royal family, and if people would like to send for that, they can. That's I think that the cost of that report, it was a two double issues. I think it's like $12 or $15. But one of the things that I saw in my research several years ago, Dr. Stan, is that when you start taking a look at the British Commonwealth. And let me just say that the proper terminology for the Commonwealth is the Commonwealth, not to put Britain, because most people know it's Britain, but some people don't. But within the United Nations system, the Commonwealth is allowed to operate. No one has ever said to Britain, you must choose. You either disband the Commonwealth and you go alone and you get out of the United Nations, or you disband the Commonwealth and you can operate inside the United Nations. No one has ever said that to Britain. And as a result, there are 54 countries that are members of the Commonwealth. Now, some of them are still directly affiliated and associated as territories and directly part of the British Empire, if you will, or the United Kingdom. But during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Britain decolonized about 35, 40 countries. And that included Ghana and Guyana and South Africa and many other countries. But what most people don't realize is every time Britain spun off a new country, you see, at the United Nations, they were getting one vote. But as they decolonized all these countries, the former colonies got their own vote at the United Nations. So that when you start taking a look at the whole international system, you have the potential within the UN system, the United States has one vote, and the British Commonwealth has the potential of 54 votes. When you start taking a look at the World Trade Organization, the British Commonwealth has 36 votes. When you take a look at the IMF, they have 35 votes. When you take a look at the World Bank, they have 34 votes. Interesting, that's just how it pans out. Now, everybody is concerned about NAFTA and the Trans-NAFTA corridor. But let's take a look at what NAFTA is part of. NAFTA is part of the free trade areas of the Americas. That is our equivalent to the European trade zone, but it's in our hemisphere. And of the 33 countries in our hemisphere that are part of and being moved into the free trade areas of the Americas, Britain has no less than 13 of her Commonwealth members in our hemisphere. So that means that when they set up the parliament for this hemisphere, just like the European Parliament, this will be the America's Parliament, whether it's the Organization of American States or whether it's something different, the bottom line is that the Commonwealth will outvote us in this hemisphere. So does the sun never set on the British Empire? It certainly appears that way.
And most people think the British Empire is dead. They don't understand the Commonwealth or its power today. And, of course, they have their agents planted in all of these Commonwealth nations.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Now, let's take a look at NAFTA. Very interestingly, you have Canada. Canada is bought and paid for and owned and controlled by the Queen. When you take a look at their parliament, yes, they have a prime minister, but the Queen has her own representative to the government, and her representative is called the Governor General. There is a Governor General in the main parliament in Montreal, and then there is an assistant Governor General in all the other provinces across Canada, so that whenever the Prime Minister reads his speech to the Parliament, the Queen's representative reads the Queen's speech, one right after the other. So now, if you start talking about merging into a new trade zone, if we just take a look at NAFTA, you have a parliamentary system, you have Canada, which is owned and bought for by the Queen, and they're going to merge with the United States. I don't think people truly understand what is happening here. There is something very, very, very major happening, and it's not just the NAFTA or the Trans-NAFTA corridor, but there is a merging of greater proportion going on. If you're going to take our government and merge it in some kind of, and don't tell me that we still retain sovereignty. That's a bunch of horse pucky.
Well, of course, we really don't. And what they really want, they want to call it an American Union, either that or a North American Union to begin with. What they would really like, of course, is to unite all of the countries of the Western Hemisphere. Right now, there's so much animosity to the United States and South America that is being fostered by Hugo Chavez, who is a very close friend of Fidel Castro, who is a very close friend of David Rockefeller's daughter. And if you don't believe that, you should read David Rockefeller's memoirs. Why is David Rockefeller's daughter such a good friend of Fidel Castro, who's such a good friend of Hugo Chavez, who hates the United States? Maybe things are not what they appear to be, but anyway, they want this American Union. This is what it's all about. And as Jones says, this is the end of our national sovereignty. The reason we're not trying to stop illegal immigration, the reason that we have a catch and release program for people who come in here illegally, the reason we have steadfastly refused to do anything about the between 20 and 30 million illegal immigrants in America, is because they want to merge us with Mexico and raise our living standards to that of the Mexican peasant. And people say, that could never happen. Our leaders wouldn't do that. And I would ask why it is that George Bush sends our troops overseas to fight for freedom and, of course, is leaving our borders open and a massive invasion of the United States, which is going to lead to a multicultural, multilingual society. Los Angeles today, go to Chicago, these are no longer American cities. Go to Miami, Florida, no longer an American city. They are all foreign cities. It's exactly what they're promoting, these internationalists whose loyalty is not to America, but to this internationalist dream. Go ahead, Joan.
Well, yeah, you know, it is quite, I remember 20 years ago when I moved to the D.C. area and I was talking to a woman who would become my congresswoman. She's been such a great Republican that she's now the U.S. representative to the OECD, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. And I remember asking her, why do we want English as a second language or Spanish as a second language? And I remember she gave me such a stupid answer. But then I found out Connie Morella was basically a globalist. She was a member of the parliamentarians for, Parliamentarians for Global Action, a major liberal left communist group working for world government. And 20 years ago, she was supporting America becoming a bilingual country. I mean, my goodness. Now we have soup and we have dentists and doctors and we have, oatmeal written in two languages, you know? I mean, it's a little difficult now to weed ourselves away and get them all out. And I have to wonder if the reason for allowing all these people to come up to America very simply is this, Dr. Stan. We need workers that are going to help try and replenish Social Security because of all of the loss of life that we have suffered in America as a result of, abortion.
Well, I thought it certainly is one of the things that is being said, but I think that really they really want a multilingual, multicultural society so they can play one group against the other, so they can create civil unrest. And I really believe that since we are losing our manufacturing jobs and the housing markets begin to slow down and new constructions begin to slow down, you're going to have literally millions and millions of people out of work in America. And I believe that they know that there's going to be civilian unrest. I believe that's why they have recently passed the Military Commissions Act and the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act, why they are revitalizing the Japanese prison camps for $238 million. These are the Japanese concentration camps from 41-42, why Halliburton's been given $385 million to build new detention camps in America. When before have we ever revitalized concentration camps from 41? When have we ever before given $385 million to Dick Cheney or anybody else's old company to build detention camps in America? What are they planning? I think they know exactly what's going to happen, and I think these unfortunate people who've come in from south of our border are going to be used as pawns in this vicious game, this vicious power game, which will allow the implementation of a state of national emergency to quell civilian unrest in this country. I think that they're three steps ahead of us, Joan. They're so much smarter than we are.
No, it's not that they're smarter, they're more wicked.
Well, yes, I will agree with that.
Yes, Dr. Stan, I do understand the multiculturalism. I do understand, all these things that I'm seeing. And I think that what we need to do here in America is we need to pray for peace in our own country. We need to pray that we will be smart enough to be able to stay out of war or civil war here in America.
But that's what they really want is a civil war.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the Rothschilds and Rockefellers and whoever else are going to finance both sides, just like we see in the Middle East, just like we see in Africa. I mean, this is very, very scary. I mean, it is so amazing. I'm sure, I watched, the two channels I watch are the Food Network and the Home Network. And you look at all these beautiful homes, what will 500,000 buy across the country? What will 200,000 buy across the country? America looks so idyllic. We just look, and you go and we look so, and we go shopping in our malls and everything just appears to be so wonderful and under control. And it is nothing but an illusion and a mirage to the real truth about what is being fomented at the lower level. And so I really truly feel that we had better start getting down on our hands and knees and asking God to keep America from civil war and unrest in order to keep our country.
I agree with you totally. And I think people have to understand that nothing happens by accident. I mean, they did not, you know, just accidentally leave the borders open and refuse to, enforce our immigration laws. They did it intentionally. These are not stupid people. They could have stopped this whole thing a long time ago, but they didn't want to. They wanted to create the situation that we're moving into. They wanted to destroy the industrial base of this country. They wanted to ship our jobs overseas. They wanted to bring in massive numbers of people to compete with the middle class and, of course, force wages down. They're following the pattern laid out in the Earth Charter where they call. I mean, this is Gorbachev. Maurice Strong and Stephen Rockefeller call for the equitable distribution of wealth within nations. Why, that's communism. And equitable distribution of wealth within nations. That's between nations. That's what we're in the process of doing now, as our wealth is being transferred to India and China and Mexico and of course, our American people are becoming increasingly indebted. Well, Joan, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, you know what? I am waiting for the Queen to give up 10 of her castles, for Prince Charles to do the same, for them to open up the vaults of the Tower of London, for all the other major royal families of the world to do that. I truly believe that if we are going to have equitable distribution of wealth, that it really should start with the wealthy. And then work its way down to us.
But of course, they're not talking about equitable distribution of their wealth. They're talking about equitable distribution of our wealth. The middle class, the wealthy, of course, are not going to share their wealth. That's all talk. But what they want to do is impoverish the middle class, and so we'll have a two-class society. The very wealthy, the royalty, the military, the bureaucracy, and then, of course, the large masses of poor people like they have in Sydney and Mexico and in most South American countries.
Well, you know, I recently watched the movie of Zorro, the remake of Zorro, and, you know, you had the Dons and then you had the poor people, and I really feel that we need to find a Zorro. And if we can't find a Zorro, then each one of us will have to be Zorro. And the place for us to be Zorro is down on our knees first, because the only way that we can protect, the only way that we can stop, is on our knees. And I have to invoke Second Chronicles 7:14. If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked way, then will I hear from heaven and heal their land. And I think as we go into the holiday season, that this has to be foremost in our mind. We are, as you have pointed out, as we have discussed in this hour, we are on the verge of losing the most important, not the most important thing, which is our salvation and our soul, but we are in the process of losing our country. And for that reason, we need to understand what is happening, the war and the battle. And for that reason, please call or go to my website, 301-371-0541. Order my new 2.5-hour video, World Government Connecting the Dots. It's time for each one of us to start opening our mouth and talking about what nobody really wants to talk about.
All right, fine. Well, our guest has been Joan Vian this evening, and I really, this is a fascinating subject, a fascinating a presentation, and of course, I don't know anybody who could present it as well as Joan. In fact, I don't know anybody who has talked about this. It's so vitally important. Hold just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been Joan Vian. Joan, I want you to give that telephone number and website out one more time.
The number is 301-371-0541.
One more time.
301-371-0541, womensgroup.org.
God bless you. Thanks very much. We'll look forward to having you in one of our other programs real soon.
God bless you. God bless America.
Amen. Bye-bye, Joan. All right, fine. That was Joan Vion, and Joan really did a great job this evening. You might very well want to think about getting a copy of the tape. As an introduction, you certainly would want to get a copy of her letter, where she has this laid out very, very well. It's hard to cover in 1 hour, but she did a yeoman's job. We do carry her book on the Sustainable Prince, Prince Charles, the Sustainable Prince. And we have her other book that goes into this whole idea of sustainable development. Both books are must reading to have a grasp of what this is about. If you have not yet read The Earth Charter, which is the Mein Kampf that's being followed today, it's included in our Sustainable Development syllabus. Now, you can go up on the Internet and pull it down. Get it down and read it. We're talking about a new spirituality. We're talking about a new structure of government. We're talking about the end of America as a sovereign state. And when you understand that, so much of what's going on makes sense. Let me suggest that you seriously consider getting our material. Certainly my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, is a good place to start, and or you can get the video or the DVD. Now, if you're ready, have access to a computer, you can actually, and don't want to, you want to watch it on the computer, you can go up on the computer and Google in Radio Liberty video, Brotherhood of Darkness, or Brotherhood of Darkness video, and you can see that, and a number of our videos are up there, and we encourage you to encourage others to watch them on the Internet, and then, of course, we hope you'll want to get them. Certainly, the purchase does help keep Radio Liberty on the air, but you can see them for nothing up on the Internet. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness. And then, of course, I think to understand how this environmental movement has been used from its beginning, there's no better place to go than my talk on the sustainable development, the road to the New World Order, and with the syllabus. You really want to get the syllabus along with that, and there's special arrangements if you get the two of them together. It will give you actually the global biodiversity assessment that was laid out by Prince Charles and the elite before the second Earth Summit that was held in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, where the current plan to use environmentalism to enslave the world was laid out by the financial and ruling elite, including, of course, Al Gore was there, and the major bankers and corporate heads from across the world met on the ship Britannia, the Prince's royal yacht, and of course laid out this blueprint for this idea of a sustainable world by, of course, taking away all freedom and redistributing the wealth of everybody, but of course the wealth of the very elite. They wanted to redistribute your wealth, and they're doing it right now. And point 10 of the Earth Charter talks about the equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. If you don't have the ability to get the Earth Charter, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge. But you can, if you get some of the other things, you can ask for it as well. We hope you'll want to get my material on how they're poisoning your children with fluoride. We have a VHS entitled The Hidden Agenda. That's The Hidden Agenda. There's a syllabus that goes with that, and we suggest you get them together. We have a talk that tells you about all the wars in the last century, how they were all contrived. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story. It's a sequel to what's little known about wars and revolutions. It's the same story, but we had to alter the syllabus so we wouldn't get into copyright infringement. But there's a syllabus that goes with that. And you understand that everything was contrived. The Spanish-American War, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, we don't mention the Order of the Garter and Emperor Hirohito and why he was never punished, but he was just playing his part. It's all a game. I understand, unfortunately, an awful lot of brave men fight and die because they really want, of course, to preserve American freedom without understanding what Henry Kissinger had said. And the quotation comes from the final days where Henry Kissinger said, "Our military is simply stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy purposes." Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Before we go on, I do want to mention that as of the 15th of January, we are going to be changing over and we're going to be, our afternoon program will be at 9.480. This is our shortwave communication. Our afternoon shortwave will be 9.480. Our evening will be 5.755. The afternoon, 9.480. The evening of 7.55 and 5.755. That's 9.480 in the afternoon, 5.755 in the evening, and so we hope that you'll be listening on shortwave if you're not listening on internet or one of the stations out there, and that you'll encourage others to listen, because we have the ability to reach people all around the world by shortwave, by satellite, and there you can listen 9 hours a day on Telstar 5. And then you can hear Joyce Riley as well for 9 hours a day. And we've got a couple of other great people on Telstar 5. We've got our own satellite up there. I don't say we've got our own satellite. We've got a slot on one of the satellites. And of course, if you're interested in getting the dish, it's really a very inexpensive and an excellent means of obtaining the information. So we recommend it to you. And then, of course, if you're interested in helping Radio Liberty, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this hour we're going to have with us Ron Brown, and Ron is a good friend, and we're going to be talking about what's going on financially in the world. It was announced today that Ford Motor Company had bought out about half of its employees in this country, so about 35,000 Ford employees are going to retire. That will give them a very, very small staff here in the United States. And you have to understand that Ford is transferring its production facilities into Mexico certainly into China as well. And Ford has actually borrowed over $18 billion and has pledged all of its assets as security for the $18 billion loan. If they do not, of course, start making a profit, Ford Motor Company will be, well, like the Hudson Motor Company or the Studebaker Motor Company, simply a remembrance of things past. And it will be the changing of an era. General Motors, as you know, is moving its base to China. General Motors is the largest producer of cars in China today. Toyota is, of course, gaining ground, and Toyota is becoming number two here in the United States. And that's part of a long-range plan covered in a four-tape set we have called The New Order of the Barbarians. We're back in 1969. Dr. Dunnigan Hurd, the head of Planned Parenthood's medical division, the medical director of Planned Parenthood, Dr. Richard Day, tell a group of doctors in 1969 in Pittsburgh exactly what was going to happen, and part of that involved making American cars poorly so we could transfer car production to Japan. And so the Japanese cars would be better than American cars, and we would transfer production to Japanese automakers. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that nothing happens by accident. We do have that four-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarians, and it's the only tape set we have that we can get a transcript along with it, if you'd like. But let's get to our special guest this evening, Ron Brown, because these are exciting times financially. Certainly the stock market seems to be getting a little weak. We know the dollar is getting weak. And in face of rising oil prices and falling stock market, what do we see? Why, we see gold and silver going down. Doesn't make any sense, does it, Ron?
No, but on the short term, of course. And what I've found out, I've been in this business for 28 years now, is that what I've discovered is that whenever there's an event or something that happens in the economy or the geopolitical scene that logically would tell you that gold or silver should rise, about 95% of the time on the short term it'll go down, because the people that are orchestrating events know exactly what momentum is in the market, and so they will counteract it with their little tricks. So
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Ron Brown. All right, Ron, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story?
I was to say, just throughout my experience, that whenever an event happens that should drive gold up, it'll usually go down on the short term. I remember, in fact, when Reagan got elected to the president, everyone was talking before the election that if he got elected, the gold would spike and go into a tailspin because the Republicans would get the economy back under control, and therefore the panic in the gold would cease. And yet the day after election, and for maybe 2 or 3 days, gold was up $20 or $30, just the opposite of what you would have expected. But what happened is, in fact, I had the guy that was my boss at the time, he was betting that that gold would drop, and he had shorted gold right before the election, and gold went up, knocked him out of his short position, and then turned around and went right back down. So the market will always be hard to second guess on a day-to-day basis.
And I think that's absolutely right, and that's why people shouldn't really try to second guess it, unless you have inside information. Why, of course, it's usually going to go just 180 degrees opposite from what you anticipate.
Like that, say, unless you're a fly on 100 walls, you're not going to have the inside information.
Right.
Because there's so much going on behind the scenes that none of us are privy to.
And, of course, basically what happens is you've got Goldman Sachs and the Japanese bankers. They will be shorting gold and they'll be shorting silver. And by shorting that and selling gold that they don't have, they can actually drive the price down. It's a great trick. It's a great scam. And then when the price gets really down and a lot of people are in there speculating who shouldn't be, they have lost their shirt. Then, of course, they'll Goldman Sachs and the others will go in and cover their short positions and come out with a big smile. And, of course, they've usually wiped out a few of the people who thought they were smart enough to play this game.
Right. 95% of the people who trade commodities lose because they're going up against some savvy traders who have inside information. In fact, they can make things happen. So, you know, it's kind of the equivalent of saving your money for 6 months, take $10,000, hop a plane to Vegas, and go into one of the large casinos and say, I want a house game. You know, you've got $10,000 going up against their $50 million, you're probably not going to win. But that's what speculation, you know, why people need to stay away from that.
You know, of course, it's the old adage that the thing that drives the market and gambling and this speculation is greed. You always think you're going to be able to outsmart the experts, and then, of course, the other thing that drives it, the market, is fear. And when you finally realize that you're not smart enough to do this, you can't sleep at night, your stomach goes into knots, and eventually, of course, why you're forced out. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown, and Ron does support Radio Liberty, and of course we support Ron. We think he's a great guy and always enjoy having him on. Certainly, you know, did you see that article by Dr. Corsi that posted on WorldNet Daily about, you know, the real deficit for this coming year, and the Congress has required apparently the Treasury to tell us to do a proper accounting. They have one, of course, in and out funds, which, of course, you never allow a major corporation to do. So Congress has demanded the government actually print what the real federal deficit is, and they're talking about $241 billion, but the real deficit for next year is going to be over $4 trillion with all the liabilities that they're taking on because of all the baby boomers are going to be retiring and get Social Security and Medicare, and all the federal government employees are going to retire, and all the military are going to retire, and with a $4 trillion deficit for just this 1 year, and they're telling the American people it's $241 billion. That's the most incredible scam of all time, and there's probably not one person in 1,000 in America who's ever heard that.
The version I heard of it, it was $4.6 trillion for the year ended 2006. In other words, this last September. So it's something that's already happened.
Right.
And remember, last time I was on air with you, I was talking about the hideous number of $3.5 trillion for the year 2005. And now they're just upping it by, what, over $1 trillion in 1 year. And, of course, most people think the deficit's running $250, $300, $400 billion, when in reality it's almost 20 times what they report.
Well, they really can't tell the American people because they begin to take defensive action, realizing that they're going to have to look after themselves because down the line, there's just not going to be any Uncle Sam up there to provide for them. What people do not understand is you hear about the communist countries, socialist countries like Russia and China. We have far more socialism and socialist programs in the United States than they ever had in Russia, than they ever had in communist China. People don't understand that we've done all these wonderful things, but we can't afford to do it. And this whole thing, the House of Cards, is beginning, of course, to tremble right at the present time.
That's exactly right. And, the dollar is nothing more than a Ponzi scheme, as we've discussed many times. It's not based on anything intrinsic value. It's just based on debt. So as this debt structure gets larger and larger and larger, and you have to pay the interest on that debt because we borrow the money through this private corporation called the Federal Reserve System, then it gets harder and harder to sustain that debt structure. And so you have to keep printing more and more money to pay the interest on the debt, and eventually it's just going to spin out of control. And I think we're in the terminal stage, by the way, Dr. Stan. I think we're very, very close to the end of the dollar system as we know it.
Well, of course, they're talking about an Amero. They're talking about a common currency for all of North America. And, of course, how will you get the American people to give up the dollar? Well, they won't have to give it up. It won't have any value. And they'll have to have some sort of a currency system. And what better currency system would there be than a currency that would involve both our good friends on the north and the south, and then we could easily trade back and forth. We wouldn't have to worry about exchanging dollars for pesos, American dollars for Canadian dollars. We'd all have the same currency. Wouldn't that be nice?
Plus, at the same time, sells a bill of goods that we're extracting all these natural resources down in Mexico and Canada that we've pretty much depleted in this country. So, if all you're looking at is the dollar sign on the tip of your nose, you could probably argue that might be a good thing. But if you step back and say, what is the real significance of that? The very fact that we're going to a common currency for three countries would absolutely mean that we've just given up our national sovereignty. So we therefore no longer have a government of law, a constitutional republic, which I admit we've been ignoring it for the last 50 years, but at least it's on the books. And if we ever had a revival in America, we could go back and take our country back. But if we ever go to this new currency, that'll be a dead issue.
I certainly agree with you, and I think that people have to begin to understand that they're going to have to begin to preparing to look after themselves and realize we're entering very, very, very difficult financial times because we've adopted a unsound monetary system. History records that the stability of a society is dependent upon the stability of the currency. And of course, we've been seeing the dollar really over the last couple of years. It's gone down from about $1.24 valued against a basket of currencies down to, what are we, about 82 cents now?
It peaked in late 01, early 02, at 121 on the dollar index.
Okay.
And then we went into a tailspin through late 2005, or through 2005, and it dropped all the way to 80.5%, or 80.5, which is a drop of 35% in that, two, 3 years, which was starting to have a tremendous impact on the economy and foreigners' view of the dollar, so they had to come back in and try to prop it up. So for over a year, all the central banks came to the rescue, propped the dollar up to around 92.6, and then just over the last 4, 5, 6 months, it's gone from 92 straight down to 82 now.
Well, I think it was really a very, very interesting that it was just last week when the Secretary of the Treasury and I think Ben Bernanke went to China. Now, ordinarily, of course, you are the strong individual. You have the strength, financial strength. Other countries come to you. But in this instance, we do not have the financial strength. Our Secretary of the Treasury and our Chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank went with hat in hand to Communist China. that has a $1 trillion in foreign reserves, the largest foreign reserves of any nation in the world. I think Japan is about second with about $800 billion in foreign reserves. We were pleading with Japan, with China, to increase the value of their currency so that we could lower our currency and make our goods certainly more competitive, and that would help our balance of payments. Do we have any idea what really happened over there, Ron? I hear all sorts of rumors, but have you heard any scuttlebutt on what was really decided?
I've heard so many versions of what's going on. I know our Congress is threatening to put sanctions or tariffs on China if they don't allow their currency to rise against the dollar. And then they're threatening to dump $1 trillion or dump their dollar reserves. So it's kind of a game of brinksmanship. And what's funny is I saw a report that when China announced that they were threatening to dump all those dollars, the euro said, we can't print enough dollars to exchange for you, because they were going to dump their dollars and exchange them for euros. At the same time, the Middle East, the OPEC nation, said, if you do that, if you destroy the dollar, then it's going to hurt our business, so we're going to embargo oil. So it's a very complicated game that's being going on here. But the simple fact is that the U.S. has been borrowing money from the foreigners for the last, 30, 40 years, I guess. And just since you and I have been talking, Dr. Stan, I remember when we first was talking, you were saying that we needed $1 to $1.5 billion a day of foreign money to come in just to keep the treadmill going. Then it went to $2 billion. Then last year we were talking $2.5 billion, and now we're talking $3 billion a day of foreign capital just to keep the treadmill going. So at some point, this thing, despite all the efforts of central banks around the world to try to keep this thing under control, they're going to lose control of it, and it's going to spin out very, very quickly, and I think we're getting to that point.
Well, you know, if we were an independent nation, if we were not the reserve currency for the world, we could probably keep this game of going for a lot longer period. It's like a monopoly game, and you simply keep bringing more money into the monopoly game so that nobody ever goes bankrupt. It's a wonderful system. But, you know, unfortunately, we have other countries that seem to have the desire to protect their own economy. China wants to protect its own economy. It wants its economy to grow. How does it grow? Why, it keeps the value of its currency low. And then, of course, their goods are so competitive here. Nobody in the United States, in fact, nobody in the world can compete effectively with communist China and the goods that they're producing. Incidentally, the reason that they have this tremendous industrial base, it was all built with American tax money, World Bank money, International Monetary Fund, Asian Development Bank, Export-Import Bank, down on the line from all of the various means by which the United States and American corporations, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, fund literally tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars to create this economic miracle in China that is destroying the foundation of the manufacturing base of America. And none of this makes sense unless there's some sort of another agenda. But at the present time, why, China is becoming the manufacturing center of the world. We will have nothing or very, very little to export other than our airplanes. And unfortunately, why, the Chinese can make the airplanes just as well as we can. It's only a matter of time before they're making their own Boeing or what, call it what you will, airplanes. Certainly, you know, and why should they sacrifice their economic base to help us? I mean, that is why our Secretary of the Treasury and the head of our central bank went with hat in hand to China. They probably made a few concessions, agreed that they'd do the right thing. But why should they think we believe that they will tell the truth and do the right thing? Not only that, but they could always simply expropriate everything that we have over there. Many of our corporations have invested literally, you know, tens of billions of dollars, but it's all guaranteed by the American taxpayer. So if the Chinese communists expropriate the factories that have been built by American companies over there, why, the American taxpayer has to pay for them. And the American taxpayer has no idea what's really going on. We'll be back here in just a moment with Ron Brown as we analyze what's going on in the world. And of course, if you have any questions or comments, why, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I've been watching things unfold for 44 years economically, and I really believe that we're rapidly approaching the end of the economic system as we've known. Well, Ron, you go ahead and pick up the story there. Tell us what's happening as far as gold and silver purchases and what your thoughts are.
Well, we went over the dollar. You know, the dollar had one drop from 2002 down to 80, rallied up to 90. Now we're going back to retest that previous low, which is now a support level. But once we break through there, then we're going to go into the next major leg down on the dollar. And, of course, that's going to have unbelievable implications on our economy, on the housing market, on everything. But as the dollar breaks through that support level and goes into the next leg, that's when the flight out of the dollar will start to really accelerate, especially compared to what it has the last 4 or 5 years. Things are going to start happening much, much faster. So I look for gold and silver to start to rise early next year as the dollar breaks through that 80 level. Now keep in mind, it may bounce off that 80 level two or three times as the central bankers come to support it and the speculators and all the things that go on. But eventually, probably early next year, that dollar is going to break through that 80 support level, trigger a flight out of the dollar, gold and silver will start to rise. And that's really when I believe silver is going to go ballistic, because there's not very much silver out there. And once the demand starts to rise, as the flight out of the currency accelerates, then the shortages of silver will dry up very, very quickly. And all these bankers who've been manipulating the silver market on the COMEX with their paper contracts will lose their power, because once the physical shortage of silver starts to manifest, those paper contracts aren't going to drop silver down. So then they have to rush to cover their shorts, and I understand they're short something like 250 to 300 million ounces, not to mention probably a lot of paper contracts that people are sitting there holding a receipt that says you've got so much silver stored in Switzerland or some other bank, when in reality it's not there to back it. So all these shortages are going to start coming to the surface very, very quickly. And then on top of that, and here's is the real kicker and why I think silver is going to perform so much better than gold. If you take the market cap or the value of all the gold in the world that could possibly come into the market and compare it to all the silver in the world that could come into the market, the value of the gold is 200 to maybe 300 times the value of all the silver. So once the shortage of silver starts to manifest, silver will continue to outperform gold. More and more people will wake up to this unbelievable silver story and say, I need to trade a little bit of my gold for silver. If just 1% of the money in gold were there to try to get into the silver market, that would have the impact of tripling the value of the silver market basically overnight. So I tell people that gold and silver are about ready to go ballistic as we go into the terminal stage of this dollar system, and it's going to happen much, much quicker than people can anticipate, because over the last 4 years it's just been a gradual rise, which hadn't been all bad. 300 or 200% rise in silver, it's been pretty good.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly concur. I think that certainly I think that silver right at the present time is really worth the, you know, is really undervalued. The thing that intrigues me would be, what about China and Russia, which of course have very, very large reserves, going ahead and really starting to buy up gold or buy up silver? We've heard that both Russia and China are beginning to purchase more in the way of gold. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Everyone's going through the motions of trying to support the dollar because we've been the world's reserve currency.
Hold that thought. We'll be back. Yeah. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Ron Brown. And I was asking Ron, you know, we hear these rumors about China and Russia, both of whom have very large reserves. China has reserves of about $1 trillion. And now that's not all in dollars. I think about 70% of it's in dollars, and I suppose the rest is in other dollar, other currencies, and they have some gold. And then Russia has well over $200 billion in reserves, you know, getting up to $250 billion in reserves. But my understanding is that Russia is beginning to buy gold, because there's an old rule that you as the gold rules. And, of course, you know, if China would start to actually begin to purchase gold to protect her currency, to protect the stability of her nation, you see, our leaders have no loyalty to the United States. Their loyalty is this internationalist dream. And they don't care what happens to America. They don't care whether the American people are impoverished or if our currency crumbles. Their desire is a new world order, a new world religion. But the Chinese seem to have a different agenda, as do the Russians. They seem to be wanting to look after their own people. Our leaders are not interested in looking after the Americans because their loyalty is not here. So where do we stand? And I just didn't ask you that, but now all of our listeners are back. What do you think about this prospect of China and Russia beginning to shift their reserves into gold? Wouldn't that have a tremendous pressure, upward pressure on the price of gold and or silver?
Well, sure, you've already seen it. Gold has gone from 250 to, 730 last May. Silver's gone from $4 to $15 last May. So all that is, you know, all that demand coming out of China and Russia is part of that picture. But last year, Russia announced they were going to double their gold reserves, and very quickly China said, we're going to quadruple ours. Now, we know there's evidence of that because they've opened up the Shanghai Exchange, where they're now making gold, and silver available to the Chinese peasants. They can get it through, I forget how many outlets throughout China, and now they're announcing they're going to start their own commodity exchange here pretty soon. So, sure, they're trying to, you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, I've been saying, Dr. Stan, that China and Japan and the rest of the world, who's been so totally dependent on the U.S. for trade, have been jockeying for position to slowly build their own internal markets where they don't need to trade with us as much, and we're getting to that. They're getting to that point. So as they do, then they're going to slowly keep phasing out of their dollars and put as many of them into gold and euros as they can without upsetting the apple cart. But they keep accumulating and accumulating and accumulating, and of course, at some point, they'll just panic and run for the exits, and then the dollar will collapse very quickly, and that's when we'll have the impetus for this new Amero, this new currency, and the monetary reform we've been talking about.
But you know, Ron, I believe that the average American cannot believe this could happen. I mean, we've got this idea that this is the way it's always been. The dollar's always been the dominant currency. It's gone up and down, but the idea that we might be witnessing the death of the dollar is so foreign to most people's way of thinking.
Who was it that said the one thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history? If you think about it, we've been in a false period of prosperity built on just inflated money and foreigners buying up our dollars and financing our deficits because they wanted to trade with us, and they've been doing that for 27 straight years. Well, if you think about it, the average man or investor doesn't really get involved and invest until he's, what, 30 years old or so? So you probably have most investors out there over 50 have never seen a recession in this country. It's just been the dollar, it's been straight up in the economy and the dot-com bubble and the real estate bubble, and they don't know what a depression is like. If you don't read history, you're not going to understand what can and will happen, because all fiat systems throughout history have always failed. I don't know why we think this one would be any different.
Well, I think that hope springs eternal in the heart of inexperienced people. But, of course, there's a law of gravity, and that is whatever goes up is going to come down. And when you have this totally artificial economy, when you have a housing market that's done what our housing market has done, and we've been able to keep it going by letting people buy homes for nothing down. I had a friend who actually bought a home, and he got $25,000 for buying the home. It was appraised at the higher value, so he just took the difference between, you know, what it was appraised at and, of course, what he paid for it, and pocketed the money and just came out with a big smile on his face. But you can't keep doing this thing indefinitely. And now, of course, the housing market's beginning to level off. It's estimated that probably, you know, maybe about 1 in 5 homes is going to go into foreclosure over the next, four or 5 years. And an awful lot of people are in homes who didn't have the money or the ability to make the payments on those homes. And, well, there are an awful lot of people who built homes, you know, and they built them, you know, a year ago to sell. They thought they'd sell immediately, and they're standing there empty, and they're paying the interest on their loans. But how long could they hold out? How long before they're going to go into default? Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Ron Brown, and we were just talking about the housing market. And of course, there are some people who have really made tremendous profits through this housing bubble. But they use the housing bubble, of course, to pick up where the stock market bubble left off. But now the stock market bubble, of course, is still there, but it's built on no relationship between the value of the stocks and, of course, the productive capacity of the earning of the stocks. They're running, 25 to 29 to 1? What's the price-earnings ratio?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, over 25 for sure. I mean, that's way too high.
So
in historical terms,
if you really want to get back to some value in the stock market, it would drop half to two-thirds in value, and then of course there's no more housing bubble. The housing bubble's gone. So when the stock market bubble goes and the housing bubble goes, and then we turn to our manufacturing, but there isn't any manufacturing there, and then this massive debt that can never be repaid overlying the market. And all the baby boomers are going to start be eligible for retirement next year. And, of course, in other words, they'll be 62 years of age, and now they can retire. And then 3 years after that, they can begin to draw their Medicare. And so we're going to have some real problems financially.
We've been trying to explain how they've kept this bubble going from this economy going from one bubble to the next. Let me just try to paint a picture. From the year 2001 through 2005, mortgage debt in America went from $5.3 trillion to $8.9 trillion. That's a 68% increase in 5 years. Now, the wealth effect from that is humongous because people sitting there with a house. In fact, I've got a client in California. They bought a house in near San Diego. What's that little rich little place there?
I don't know. Huntington Beach, Laguna Beach, Santa Ana.
It doesn't matter. Anyway, they had paid something like $30,000 for the house 30 years ago, and when I was talking to them 2 or 3 years ago, that house was now up to $800,000. And so look at the wealth effect that's created for so many people. You buy a house, and all of a sudden it just keeps going up in value the last 5 years, 10, 12, 15%, maybe 20% a year in California. And so if you lose your job or you're getting squeezed a little bit, heck, you've got free money there. All you got to do is go to the bank and refinance it and pull out $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. So that tremendous increase in mortgage debt over that period, it created a lot of wealth effect and a lot of false prosperity because people could borrow from their equity.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before we go on, Ron, I want you to get your telephone number out. And do you have a website yet?
No, I don't. I'm too lazy for that, Dr.
All
Stan.
Right. Well, that's fine.
My number is 1-800-595-0561.
One more time, please.
1-800-595-0561.
And what will people get if they give you a call?
Well, they can call me and talk to me anytime, but I do have a package of information that kind of is a starter package to get people a little overview of what's going on and why you need to be looking at gold and silver and what's about to happen to the economy and the dollar and so forth. So a lot of people that get it from me say they enjoy it because I try to put it in very short terms for the layman so he can understand, because most people get scared to death when you talk economics, you know, and start using all the highfalutin terms, and it just goes over their head.
Well, no, I've read it, and I think you did a good job on that. Well, my telephone number, if you'd like to talk to Ron, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, you know, so most people's attention is focused on what's going on in the Middle East. And, you know, what's taking place there is really one of the great human tragedies of modern times. The Johns Hopkins study suggests over 500,000 Iraqis have died, over and above what you would have expected to die here in the last couple of years, as a result of America's invasion, and things are going from bad to worse. And there is no way out of the situation they've created. If we stay there, why, of course, there's going to be chaos. If we pull out, there's going to be chaos. And, of course, what we've done is strengthen the hand of Iran. We've destroyed Iran's enemies. We've destroyed the Taliban, who the Iranians hated. We've destroyed Saddam Hussein, who the Iranians hated. We've done a wonderful job to make Iran stronger than ever. What are we going to do about Iran? Did we go over there really to position ourselves for an attack on Iran? They tell us our military is pretty well broken. If our military is broken, can we hazard an attack on Iran simply using planes and cruise missiles? And what impact will that have on the rest of the world? We will be violating all the various precepts of international law when we do that. What will happen to our leaders if they're called, you know, before an international body to stand trial after having killed over 600,000 people in Iraq unnecessarily in a war that they lied to get us into because they knew that Saddam, the weapons of mass destruction, if they existed, were not of any consequence? But think of the implications. You see, men and women here in America are certainly responsible for what our government does, and men and women become accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose. But while our attention is focused on the Middle East, what is happening to America is far worse. America is under attack from immigration. But the biggest danger to America, in my estimation, is the financial implications of what's going on. They're talking about this war in the Middle East costing us over $2 trillion by the time we get through paying for the war. And that calculates, if we get out of there in about the next 2 years. But then, of course, we're going to have all the care of the veterans that are going to have to be cared for, many of them for the rest of their lives with permanent brain injuries or permanent disabilities. And over a third of our veterans coming back now, of the over a million men we've rotated through there, a third of them now are permanently disabled in one way or another, either psychologically or physically, or we don't know. So, I mean, and then I believe people ignore the influence of God. You know, God isn't simply ignoring what's going on. Do you think he is going to continue to support and bless a country that is doing the terrible things that our government is doing? And with the full support of the churches of this country, after all, Ted Haggard and the National Association of Evangelicals was solidly behind President Bush in everything he's done, including the torture, which is, of course, necessary. Because we have to deal with those wicked Muslims. So torturing them is all right, because after all, we're righteous and they're bad. And where is the outcry from the American people? Why, it's deafening. It is silence. Well, Ron, you know, I really am very, very concerned that, you know, certainly that we cannot maintain our economic stability with this additional massive debt of another couple of $1 trillion for this unnecessary war. This is on top of all the other debts that we have.
Well, it's all reflected in what's happening to the dollar, and as the dollar gets weaker, and since, let's face it, this whole fiat system is nothing more than a gigantic confidence game, so the only thing that gives the dollar value is our strength economically and power militarily, and as we fritter that away in this wasteful war, and our economic strength lessens, which it is very quickly, we've sent all of our jobs overseas, then the world will have no reason to respect and accept the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And once we lose that status, then they really have no reason to keep loaning us $3 billion a day. So we're just at the verge of the flight out of the dollar accelerating to a panic point. Now, it may take 2, 3, 4 years But it's coming, and in 2, 3, 4 years isn't very far from now.
No, it really isn't. Of course, we don't know what the timing on this is, but, you know, I think everyone should begin making the preparation for the difficult, very difficult times that lie ahead. Now, certainly, what do you advise your clients at the present time? And I know you've been very, very bullish on silver.
I tell people put 70-75% of their metals into silver and 25% into gold. And then as the silver outperforms gold and that gold-to-silver ratio, see, when we first started talking, and I was bullish on silver, 3-4 years ago, Dr. Stan, the ratio was about 80 to 1. In other words, gold was 80 times the price of silver. Today it's something like 45 to 46 times the price of silver. So I think the gold-to-silver ratio is going to go down to 20 and then 15 for sure, and maybe as low as 10. So that tells me that silver will outperform gold 4 or 5 fold. So that tells me to put most of my money into gold and into silver right now. But when that ratio gets down to 20, then we're going to want to switch some of our silver back into gold.
All right, fine. And so you anticipate that silver is going to go up. Now, how would people hold their silver? Would they hold it in, just take physical possession of it? Would they get it in bars? Would they get it in rounds? Would they get it in silver dollars? Would they get it in junk silver? What about the exchange-traded funds? What about silver stocks?
Okay. Well, let's take the exchange-traded fund and kind of get that out of the way. The bankers have been manipulating the price of gold and silver. In fact, they're the ones that created this monetary system that we know as a fraud. They're the ones that have created these exchange-traded funds. Now, you can't take delivery of your silver if you buy it, so you're asking the fox to guard your hen house, because you're buying silver to try to protect yourself from a failing banking system, yet it's the bankers who have created these exchange-traded funds. All the bankers know is fraction reserve banking. So while we know the silver ETF that was created a year ago has taken about 110 million ounces of real silver off the market, my guess and projection would be that as the demand for silver rises and the increase in money going into that fund increases dramatically, then they will start playing their fraction reserve banking game, and they won't have the amount of money silver to back what it's supposed to be. They'll find all sorts of little tricks to, they'll start monetizing silver in the ground, So if you really want to help drive the price of silver up, you need to buy real silver and take possession of it. So I would tell people, other than maybe for speculation, don't buy the ETFs. Buy the real thing and store it yourself.
All right, now what about, of course, should you be in silver dollars? Is there a shortage of silver dollars, I've heard? Is that true or not?
Yeah, there's going to be a shortage of dollars. And in fact, that's an interesting market. For years, from the late, let's say, 80 on through the 90s, the silver dollars always traded at a very high premium, even the junk dollars. They would be like 140% premium over the value of silver. But in this latest rise in silver, they have not kept pace. And I would attribute that to the fact that in 86, the Mint came out with the silver eagle, and a lot of people, one, confuse it with the silver dollar, but that eagle is such a beautiful coin that people kind of went to that and left the dollar, it's been kind of getting secondary interest. So it hasn't kept pace, but just recently I had a client try to buy 500 of them. And it's taken my dealer about a month and a half, 2 months, just to get 500 coins.
No, is that $500 or 500 of the eagles?
500 of the silver dollars, excuse me.
Okay, fine. So the silver dollars are pretty hard to come by at the present time.
Yeah, they're getting tight, and I suspect when this thing really blows out of the water, then all these numismatic dealers will jump on the silver dollars and hype them, and they'll just play catch-up very, very quickly. So you can't go wrong buying some. But where I would tell people to start would be with a junk bag of dimes. Get silver in very small increments. So if we ever get into a period of chaos or whatever, you always have that silver that you could potentially use for barter. And, if you think about it, it doesn't really matter whether we ever get to that point. It's the perception by people that we will get to that point that makes those coins very, very valuable in times of international strife.
All right, fine. Well, then, certainly, what about things like silver rounds? What about the silver eagle?
Silver eagle really is, other than get your first bag or two and the junk coins, the silver eagle has become my favorite now. Now, that didn't used to be the case. When silver was trading at four and you had to pay an extra dollar, $1.25 to get them, then that was too much of a premium. But here we are with silver at $13, $14. You're still paying the same dollar extra, so the markup or the premium you're paying is not, you know, too horrendous now. And yet what I think will happen with the silver dollars, and there's already talk that when the panic into silver or the acceleration into silver starts in earnest, that the Mint's going to shut down or limit their production of those coins. And, you know, they did that back in 1999 with the little 1/10-ounce gold eagle. And in the first 2 weeks of January 99, as we kind of went into the final countdown to Y2K, if you remember those days, Dr. Stan, the 10th-ounce gold eagle went from $32 my cost to $49 my cost in 2 weeks. Now, I would suggest that's exactly what's going to happen with these silver eagles. As soon as they shut down or slow down production and put them on allocation, the coin dealers around the country will jump all over those and hype them like they're the second coming, and you'll see them go up in premium dramatically very, very quickly.
Well, now, are the Canadian 10th-ounce gold coins as valuable as the American?
Almost, not quite. You know, when you have pure gold, they have to put those 10th-ouncers in a plastic sleeve, otherwise they get all scratched up.
So are they really a pure gold for all intents and purposes?
Well, yeah. All the maple leaves are, you know, 24 carat, 999, you know, 999 fine. So when you have the little 10th-ouncers and each one is in a packet, they don't stack very neatly. When you have the U.S. Eagles, that's a 90% gold coin. It has a full 1/10 of an ounce of gold in it, but it's alloyed to give its strength, so you can buy those in little tubes, and a tube is about the size of half of a cigar, so they're very compact and very easy to store or to hide if you want to.
No, I'm sorry, what are you speaking of specifically?
That 1/10 ounce gold eagle versus the maple leaf.
I see, okay. All right, fine. Well, then, of course, some of the other things, what about the silver rounds? What about, they've had those. Are they certainly as good as the regular silver dollars, or certainly as the silver eagle?
What I tell people, any form of silver you buy is going to make you deliriously happy over the next 2 years. The silver round will never have the premium play that, let's say, the silver eagle will. So even though you pay a little bit more for the silver eagle, I think it's worth it. I'll just give you one illustration. I have a client here in Colorado Springs, and this was about 3 or 4 months ago. He called me, and he said, "Ron, I'm at a flea market, and I'm looking at some guys got some silver eagles for sale. What would be a fair price for me to offer him?" So I called my dealer and got a price and gave it to him. And about an hour later, he called me, and he was from his cell phone. He says, "Ron, I got 500 of them." And I said, "Well, come on by and let's look at them." And he came out and said, "Let's see if there's any eagles minted in 1996. And lo and behold, there was 120 of them there. We called the dealer and traded those 120 96 model 06 silver eagles for 540 2006 models of the silver eagle. The only difference is the date on them. So that gives you an idea of what kind of premium play you can get on these silver eagles when this thing really starts going ballistic to the upside, which I fully expect.
All right, fine. Well, do you think are people really getting interested in this? In other words, right now, of course, you talk to people. Are they really getting into silver, or are they just sort of sitting and waiting to see what happens?
More and more people are starting to see, I've been kind of the voice in the wilderness shouting for the last 5 years, and all of a sudden people are starting to see that it's happening. You know, the ratio is going from 80 to 46, so silver is outperforming gold. Silver is outperforming the stock market. Silver is outperforming just about every market the last 2 or 3 years. So, yes, more and more people are starting to finally wake up, and that's when the market starts to go faster, because as the public wakes up, then all of a sudden you have a massive increase in demand, and there's just very little silver out there compared to the dollars that could go into it.
Well, now, somebody had just called in, wanted to know about silver mining stocks. I know you don't deal in that, and you certainly deal in silver, but do you think there's any place for buying silver mining stock?
Absolutely. You have to be a little careful, because whenever you get into stocks, you're betting on, there's a lot more variables in the game. One, especially nowadays, is the politics of the government you're dealing with. Would I want to be investing in a gold or a silver mine in Venezuela? Probably not. South Africa, probably not. China, definitely not. But if, you know, on the other hand, you can get the leverage play. Some of these gold and silver stocks have gone up 1,000, 2,000%, while gold is going up 200% and silver is up 300%. So it gives you a leverage play, and there's a place for it. But don't let that be a replacement for the real gold and silver.
And so what you think people ought to be diversified, diversify, diversify. Have lots of, if they're going to be in silver, I'll play it every which way.
Exactly. They have different forms of silver. Have a few silver stocks, have some gold.
All right, before, let's just your telephone number just one more time out there, Ron.
It's 1-800-595-0561.
One more time.
1-800-595-0561.
All right, fine. Well, I guess it's been Ron Brown. I hope you're out there in the listening audience. Enjoyed listening to Ron. I always enjoy having him on. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Ron, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Okay, Dr. Stan, I would just, the average investor out there who's not into what's going on with the dollar and the gold market and so forth, they may be sitting there, and let's just take an illustration. Let's say they have $100,000 in their retirement program, and either a 401k or an IRA, and that money's invested in maybe U.S. stocks, some growth stocks, some income stocks, and a few bonds, but I would argue that where we're heading, they could get wiped out in the next 2 or 3 years with that position. For example, back we just talked about how the dollar dropped from 121 on the index to 80 in a matter of 2 years. Well, let's say that's 15% a year. If the dollar dropped by 15%, regardless of what your return on the money was, the purchasing power of that $100,000 has dropped about at least $15,000, and over 2 years it might be 30% or $30,000. Secondly, if the dollar drops that much, do you think it's going to have an impact on our stock market and the bond market? Do you think it's going to force interest rates higher? So you could see the value of your investments drop in 10, 20, 30%. So it wouldn't be hard to argue that in 2 years you could lose 50 to 60% of your retirement money if you stay in dollar investments. So I would just tell people they need to look at the alternative. And what's happened is the dollar unravels and loses its purchasing power. Gold and silver has always been the refuge that people go to throughout history. And gold and silver is the vehicle that will best give you a chance of bridging the gap from this one failing dollar system to that new system that's going to replace it. It looks like it'll probably be something called the Amero. So that's what I would just tell people. They need to take steps now, because it's going to start happening very, very quickly over the next 2-3 years.
Well, I think that you're probably right. I fear you're probably right. I think that we're sort of out here on the front lines trying to warn people to look after themselves, beginning to understand we're facing a financial crisis. Now, we're going to have lots of problems here in America. And certainly people say, well, don't you put your faith in the Lord? And absolutely. It's the only thing that will probably get us through. But we'd be foolish not to make all the plans we can on our own. And then, well, you work as if it's up to us and pray as it's up to the Lord. And the final analysis, it is His battle. But we're called to do our best. And time again, you read the scriptures, why the Lord favored people who did things, you know, well. And the people who just put their money in the ground and didn't do anything with their talent, why He was furious with them. And I think we're to occupy as long as we can and do the best we can. And Ron Brown, thanks so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure, Dr. Stan. Good Have time. A nice holiday.
You too. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our program to help us as we reach out 5 hours every single day during the week, and then, of course, on our weekend stations to about 30 stations, trying to educate people about what's really going on. So if you agree with our message and you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family of supporters, remember our number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you would like to really understand what is happening financially, we've put together a little pamphlet called The History of Money. It's based upon 5 of my newsletters. You can go up on the Internet and pull them down, or you can certainly get them in a pamphlet form very inexpensively. And then, of course, we have a talk. It's called The Financial Tsunami. And then, of course, there's a syllabus that goes with this Coming Tsunami. The Financial Tsunami, The Coming Tsunami. Anyway, I really think it's as good as anything you're going to find to explain the background of the hedge funds and the derivatives and the carry trade and of course how the energy crisis is going to impact on this and the housing bubble, and all of these things are focusing together. They're all coming together, and of course they're going to create a very, very difficult situation, and I think we're just on the brink of the abyss, which is going to begin to engulf so many people who have not made any preparations for what lies ahead. So if you'd like to get the pamphlet and or the talk or the syllabus or get them together, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Certainly we have an excellent book. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island. I think it's the classic book on what's happening financially today. We have another book by our friend Professor Sutton called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. You have to understand what the Federal Reserve is really all about. We carry the last book would be Fiat Money Inflation in France. It's the story of what happened in France in 1789 when they did exactly what we are doing today. And what happened? Tremendous prosperity. The breakdown of the moral and structure of French society. Everybody was living it up. The good times were rolling, and then came the day of reckoning. And, of course, the collapse of the government, the institution of a dictatorship under Napoleon Bonaparte, and then it plunged all of Europe into a great war. But if you read Fiat Money Inflation in France, a small book written 125 years ago by Andrew Dickinson White, the president of Cornell University, why it's like deja vu all over again. You have to know the past. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. It's a trite phrase, but it is really so true today. So again, The Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, The Fiat Money Inflation in France. 3 classic books on economics, and you better start doing your homework, and you better start understanding what's going on, and you better start making preparations. Let me mention, we do have healthcare products, and you know, you need to know about magnesium. We carry a book, The Miracle of Magnesium, and of course we carry a number of books on health, like Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, the book on statin drugs, the book on GMOs. We have 4 tape sets on all of these subjects. You need to know how to protect your health. And then, of course, we have a health catalog. If you'd like to get that, we have an emergency food catalog. You need to start making the preparations in case, and just pray, hope and pray it isn't going to happen, but in case they do have a military dictatorship in America, because as Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said, the John Warner Defense Authorization Act actually encourages the president to declare martial law. And George Bush was willing to launch a battle that's killed 500,000 people in Iraq. Do you really think he's concerned about the lives of the American people? Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision protection, our number 1-800-544. 800-516-8927.